Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are opening a file that looks, at first glance, like a very, very dry case of accounting. But it's not financial accounting, it's atomic accounting.
That is a great way to put it, yeah. We're essentially auditing the books on one of the most important materials in human history, Steele.
Specifically, we're looking at a paper from 1982. It's a short communication published in Metal Science, written by HKDH Padatia. The title is Application of First-Order Quasi-Chemical Theory to Transformations in Steels.
It sounds incredibly dense, I know, but the story inside is a classic detective mystery. I mean, it's about a missing number, or, well, not missing, a wrong number, a single integer that was just silently wrecking our ability to understand how steel hardens.
And this isn't just about getting an A on a physics test. The stakes here are actual infrastructure. We're talking about the fundamental formulas used to design strong, tough steels, you know, for everything from skyscrapers to high-performance engine parts.
Exactly. If you want to design those materials, you can't just guess. You need to predict how the metal behaves when it's not stable, when it's in these weird metastable states like bainite or martensite. These are the structures that give modern steel its incredible properties.
Right.
And for a long time, the model scientists were using to predict that behavior, well, it had a bug.
So our mission today is to uncover that bug. Mm-hmm. We're going to look at how a standard theory, one that everyone just sort of accepted, suddenly broke down, and how Padatia fixed it by essentially looking at the geometry of the atoms and saying, hey, wait a minute, I think you counted wrong.
It's a masterclass in going back to first principles. It really shows that sometimes when the math gets too complicated, the answer is actually in the simplest assumption you made right at the start.
Okay, so let's start with the tool they were using. First-order quasi-chemical theory. That is a mouthful. Break that down for us. What is it actually trying to do?
So imagine you have a solution. Usually we think of liquids, you know, salt dissolved in water. But steel is a solid solution. You have a crystal lattice of iron atoms, that's the solid block, and dissolved inside that crystal are these tiny carbon atoms.
Okay, so it's a mixture, but it's frozen in place.
Sort of, yeah. The atoms can still move around if it's hot enough. Quasi-chemical theory is a method to calculate the energy of that mixture. It's called quasi-chemical because it treats the bonds between atoms almost like they're chemical bonds. It asks a simple, fundamental question. If I'm a carbon atom and I sit next to another carbon atom, does the energy of the system go up or down?
So is it a happy marriage or a fight?
Precisely. We call this the pairwise interaction energy, and it's denoted by the Greek letter omega. It's trying to put a number on, like, the social friction between atoms.
I want to use an analogy here because I think the geometry is going to be really crucial later. I'm picturing a movie theater.
A classic analogy. Go on.
The theater is the iron crystal. The seats are the specific spots, the lattice sites, where atoms can sit. The iron atoms are the structure of the building. They are the rows. But the carbon atoms are the audience members trying to find a seat.
That works. That works. But with one little catch, the carbon atoms are much smaller than the iron atoms. So in this theater, they aren't replacing the seats. They are squeezing into the gaps between the seats. We call those interstitial sites.
Got it. So I'm a carbon atom. I'm squeezing into the legroom between the rows. Now, this specific model Padatia is looking at, the McLellan and Dunn model.
Sure.
It was famous for being physically realistic. What made it better than others?
It respected something called excluded volume, or to stick with your theater analogy, personal space.
Okay.
See, the really simplistic models, they just assume you can throw atoms anywhere, mathematically speaking. They assume atoms are just points with no size. But the McLellan and Dunn model, which is based on Guggenheim's formalism, said, no, atoms take up space. If a carbon atom occupies a specific gap, it blocks the gaps immediately surrounding it.
So if I sit in a gap, nobody can sit on my lab. And nobody can sit in the gap directly to my left or right.
You got it. I'm taking up too much room. It accounts for the fact that atoms have physical dimensions. And for years, this model was the absolute gold standard for a specific type of steel called austenite.
Austenite, right. That's the high-temperature form of steel. It has that face-centered cubic structure.
Exactly. In austenite, the gaps are relatively large. So when researchers plugged the experimental data into this quasi-chemical equation, it worked perfectly. I mean, the math predicted exactly how carbon behaved. The interaction energy, that omega value, was consistent. It was a huge victory for the theory.
But this is where the detective story really starts. Because eventually you have to cool the steel down. And when you cool it, austenite turns into ferrite.
Ferrite, or alpha iron. This is the body-centered cubic structure. It's what your car door, your fridge, most structural steel is made of at room temperature.
So logically, the scientists thought, okay, we have this amazing equation that works for austenite. Let's just plug in the numbers for ferrite and see what happens.
It seemed like a safe bet. I mean, science is about universal laws, right? So there was a group of researchers, specifically Shiflett, Bradley, and Aronson, who did exactly that. They took equation 2 from the model, which relates carbon concentration to its thermodynamic activity, and they applied it to ferrite data.
Yeah.
A train wreck. An absolute disaster.
Define train wreck in physics terms for me.
The numbers made no physical sense at all. When they solved for that interaction energy, omega, it was jumping all over the place. But what was worse, the values were often negative.
Why is negative bad in this context?
Well, in quasi-chemical theory, a negative interaction energy implies attraction. It means carbon atoms want to be next to each other. They want to cluster together.
But if carbon clustered in steel, wouldn't you just get lumps of graphite, like pencil lead growing inside the metal?
Exactly. If carbon strongly attracted itself in ferrite, steel as we know it just wouldn't exist. It would separate into pure iron and clumps of soot or carbides. We know from observation, from literally looking under microscopes, that carbon atoms in steel generally repel each other. They try to spread out.
So the model was predicting attraction, but reality showed repulsion. That's not just a small error. That's the literal opposite of the truth.
It is. And usually when a model fails this badly, scientists start adding what we call fudge factors. They say, oh, maybe the magnetic properties of ferrite are messing it up, or maybe there's some complex electronic interaction we missed. They start adding variables to force the curve to fit the data.
The curve-fitting trap. You make the line hit the dots, but you lose the physics.
Correct. And that is so dangerous, because if you don't understand why the line hits the dots, you can't predict what happens outside the graph.
Yeah.
You can't predict those crucial metastable states for advanced alloys. You're flying blind.
So enter our protagonist, HKDH Badesia. He looks at this broken model, and instead of adding complexity, he looks at the very bottom of the equation. He questions the absolute foundation.
He looked at the variable settler.
Just the letter.
Just the letter. It stands for the coordination number.
Okay, definition time.
Yeah.
What exactly is a coordination number?
Simply put, it's the number of nearest neighbors. In our theater analogy, if I pick a specific seat, Zeller's is the number of other seats that are directly touching me. It's the connectivity of the network.
And what number were the previous researchers, Shiflett and his team, using for Zeller?
They were using Zeller's 81.
And why did they pick 8? Was it just a guess?
No, it wasn't random. Ferrite is a body-centered cubic, or BCC, crystal. If you look at an iron atom in that structure, it is surrounded by exactly 8 other iron atoms. It's a standard property of the BCC lattice, every textbook tells you. In BCC, the coordination number is 8.
So they looked at the iron atoms and just said, okay, everything connects to 8 things.
Exactly. Intuitively, 8 feels like the right number for that crystal.
But we aren't tracking the iron atoms. We're tracking the carbon atoms squeezing into the gaps.
That is the aha moment. That is the stroke of genius in this paper. Padeshia pointed out that the geometry of the gaps, the interstitial sites, is not the same as the geometry of the atoms.
This is really hard to visualize without a diagram, but try to paint a picture for us. Where does carbon sit in ferrite?
It sits in what we call the octahedral interstices. So imagine a cube of iron atoms. The carbon tries to sit right in the middle of the face of that cube, or in the middle of an edge.
Okay, so it's perched there, wedged in. If I'm that carbon atom, how many other carbon seats are directly next to me?
In the body-centered cubic structure, the lattice is a bit distorted. It's not a perfect grid for the carbon. And because of the way these octahedral sites are squashed and stretched, you only have 4 nearest neighbor sites.
4, not 8.
4. The previous researchers had assumed that because the iron lattice is 8 coordinated, the interstitial lattice must be 2. But Padeshia showed that for the specific sites carbon actually occupies, 0 zolits equals 4.
That seems like such a tiny change. You just change an 8 to a 4 in an equation. Does it really change the answer that much?
Oh, it changes everything. Remember, this zil variable is part of the exponential term in the statistics. It defines the probability of finding a neighbor. So by telling the math there are 8 spots, yeah, and there are only 4, you are fundamentally diluting the calculated interaction. You're telling the model that the carbon has way more options than it actually does.
It's like calculating the odds of winning a lottery but getting the total number of tickets wrong by a factor of 2.
Exactly. The probability density is completely off. So Hadashia takes his calculator, this is 1982, so probably a pretty hefty scientific calculator, and he reruns the whole derivation. He changes the coordination number to 4. He takes the exact same experimental data that Shiflett and the others used. and what happens.
I'm really hoping for a Hollywood ending here.
Order from chaos.
The negative numbers disappear.
Completely. When he plotted the data with CMON44, the wild fluctuations just vanished. He was able to calculate a single consistent value for omega, the interaction energy.
And what was the number?
132,400 joules per mole.
Give us some context. Is that a lot?
It is massive. For context, thermal energy at room temperature is only about 2,500 joules per mole. So this is orders of magnitude higher.
And critically, it's a positive number.
Yes. Positive energy means repulsion. It means carbon atoms in ferrite absolutely detest sitting next to each other. They push each other away with a massive force.
So we went from a broken model predicting carbon attraction to a fixed model proving strong repulsion just by fixing the seat count.
Precisely. And there was another huge clue that he was right. In the failed models, the energy value kept drifting depending on the temperature. It wasn't a constant.
Which is a bad sign for a physical constant, right?
Yeah.
Constants shouldn't care if it's Tuesday or if it's hot outside.
Right. If your constant changes with temperature, it's not a constant. It's a variable you don't understand. But Padesh's value, this 132,400, was temperature independent. Whether the steel was hot or warm, the repulsion energy was the same. That tells you it's a fundamental property of the material. It's not just a data artifact.
That is so satisfying. It's like tuning a radio station. You turn the dial from 8 to 4, and suddenly the static clears, and you hear the music perfectly.
That's a perfect analogy. And once the music was clear, he could use it to predict the rest of the playlist.
Let's talk about those predictions, because a theory is only good if it works in the real world. The paper has a graph, figure 1. It shows the phase boundaries. What are we looking at here?
So you have a graph with temperature on one side and carbon concentration on the other. There are these lines that mark the border where ferrite turns into austenite. These are the equilibrium lines, basically the melting and freezing points, but for solid phases. Padesh used his new energy value to calculate where those lines should be, theoretically. Then he took the actual experimental data points from a researcher named Hansen, who is basically the reference librarian of metallurgy, and he overlaid them.
Oh.
A perfect fit. The theoretical curve passed right through the experimental dots.
So the math predicted reality. But the paper mentioned something else, the T$$ curve. Why is this curve so special?
Ah, this is where we get back to that high-stakes engineering I mentioned at the start. The equilibrium lines tell you what happens if you cool steel very, very slowly. But in industry, we don't cool slowly. We quench steel. We cool it fast to make it hard.
We want to trap it in those metastable states like bainite.
Exactly. We want bainite or martensite because they're strong. But to form those structures, the transformation has to happen without the carbon having time to diffuse away. The T$$ curve tells us the thermodynamic limit for that. It's the line where austenite and ferrite of the exact same composition have the exact same energy.
It's the tipping point.
It is the absolute speed limit for forming bainite. If you are on the wrong side of the T$$ curve, bainite physically cannot grow.
And because the previous models are just curve fitting, they couldn't find this line accurately.
They were guessing. And if you guess the T$$ line wrong, you might design a heat treatment process for a bridge cable or a car chassis that fails to produce the structure you want. You end up with soft steel when you needed hard steel, or brittle steel when you needed tough steel.
So Padesh's correction didn't just fix a textbook. It gave engineers the map they needed to navigate the danger zone of non-equilibrium cooling.
Correct. It allowed for the thermodynamic modeling of the bainite transformation, which has basically been Padesh's life work. It's the foundation for modern high-strength steel design.
There's one last piece of evidence in the paper that I thought was fascinating. It mentions internal friction and the Snook peak.
Oh, yes. This is the cross-examination. This is independent evidence from a totally different field of physics.
How does that work?
So, internal friction is basically studying how a material vibrates. If you ping a piece of steel, it rings. But if there are atoms jumping around inside, they absorb some of that sound energy. The ringing stops faster.
It dampens the vibration.
Right. This is called the Snook effect. And by studying how the steel absorbs energy, you can figure out exactly where the carbon atoms are sitting and how they are jumping.
And what did those vibration experiments show?
They showed that carbon atoms never occupy nearest neighbor sites. The signals indicated that if a carbon atom is in one spot, the neighboring spot is always empty.
They treat the neighbor like the floor is lava.
Exactly. And this was purely mechanical data, no thermodynamics involved. But look at what Padesh found. A massive positive repulsion energy.
Which means the thermodynamics is saying the exact same thing as the vibration experiments.
Bingo. The C8-rate model contradicted the vibration data. It suggested attraction, or at least a very weak interaction. The Zeodorda-4 model aligned with it perfectly. It connected the dots between mechanical spectroscopy and thermodynamics.
It really highlights how fragile a scientific truth can be. You can have a room full of brilliant people running complex simulations, but if the foundational assumption, the geometry of the room, is wrong, it's all just garbage.
It's the black box problem.
Yeah.
Shiflett and the others were treating the quasi-chemical equation like a black box. They fed numbers in, didn't like the output, and tried to tweak the input or add factors to the output.
Adesia opened the box and realized the wiring was wrong.
He realized that equation 2 wasn't some universal law sent down from the heavens. It was a derivation based on a specific geometry. And if you change the crystal, you have to change the derivation.
The paper ends with the simplified equation.
Right.
Equation 4.
Yes. Padishi basically says, look, the repulsion is so strong, that 132,000 number, that we can essentially treat it as infinite. We can just assume nearest neighbor sites are always empty.
Simplicity on the other side of complexity.
Exactly. He provides a simplified formula that engineers can use to calculate carbon activity without needing a supercomputer or complex iteration. It's robust, it's physically based, and it's easy to use.
So we've rescued the reputation of quasi-chemical theory. It wasn't that the theory was bad at all, it was just misapplied.
It was a case of mistaken identity regarding the lattice sites.
I think this is a great takeaway for our listeners, even if they aren't metallurgists. We rely on so many standard models in our work. Marketing funnels, agile projections, economic forecasts.
We assume the variables, the SEER numbers, are set in stone.
But are they? That really is the question.
It really is.
Before we wrap up, I want to leave you with a thought. Beshev found this error because he didn't just trust the formula. He visualized the physical reality it was supposed to represent. He pictured the atoms. In your own field, are you using a Z8 setting when you're actually working in a Z4 environment? Are you applying a rule of thumb that worked for your last project, your austenite phase, to a new, more constrained project, your ferrite phase, and wondering why the numbers just aren't adding up?
It's always tempting to just add a fudge factor to make the deadline, to force the fit.
But as we saw today, the real breakthrough comes when you stop forcing the fit. Go back to the very beginning and just recount the seats.
Measure twice. Calculate once.
Thanks for diving deep with us today.
A pleasure, as always.
We'll catch you on the next one.